A Democrat has officially filed to run for U.S. Senate. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Catherine Fry tells us about a company that will replace Glacier Park Incorporated. And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the Montana Government Relations Director of the Cancer Action Network about how the state's policies affect cancer prevention outcomes. A Democratic candidate has announced a bid for U.S. Senate. Wausau, Montana rancher and political newcomer Dirk Adams announced his candidacy this week, the first Democrat to officially do so. Earlier this year, veteran Senator Max Baucus said he will not seek re-election in 2014. This touched off a flurry of speculation of who will run for the seat on both sides of the aisle. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says not much is known about Dirk Adams, and the candidate himself is not saying much yet.
Rancher Dirk Adams unveiled his candidacy during a weekly breakfast meeting of the Yellowstone County Democrats this Wednesday. That group's central committee chair, Joe Raffiani, says Adams called him last week saying he was going to run. Raffiani says Adams claims he is a lifelong Democrat, yet politically, he's unknown.
He is not someone with whom we are intimately familiar here in Yellowstone County.
Adams did not return several calls seeking comment. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports the 62-year-old Adams has ranched in the Wausau area north of Livingston since the mid-80s. He declined to tell the paper why he's running. He does have a website, clearly in its preliminary stages. It does say more jobs should be made in America and working and poor should not be words that appear together. Senator Max Baucus said he would be retiring from his seat back in March. Political observers expected former Governor Brian Schweitzer to run to keep the seat in Democratic hands, but he later quashed those rumors, saying he does not want to leave Montana for Washington, D.C. Several other prominent Democrats dropped out who had been considering the race, including Superintendent of Public Instruction Denise Juno and State Auditor Monica Lynn Dean. Chief of Strategy for the Montana Democratic Party, John Bacino, describes those types of announcements as positive.
One thing that I think of is that we've got so many great candidates in the party who have all kept their jobs or gotten the next higher job. So we've just had such sort of great growth in those folks.
The party says Dirk Adams has reached out to them and that he has been traveling a bit around eastern Montana, gauging support. Bacino says the party does not endorse specific candidates in the primary. He does mention other candidates considering a Democratic bid, including former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger, current Lieutenant Governor John Walsh, and former Polson Republican State Senator John Brueggemann. Two Republicans have announced they are running for Baucus's seat, current Missoula State Representative Champ Edmonds and former Billings State Senator Corey Stapleton. U.S. Congressman Steve Daines also says he's thinking about the race and is considered by many to be the favorite. Montana Republican Party Executive Director Bowen Greenwood says the GOP is very happy with their candidates in the race so far. He believes Democrats are having trouble finding candidates because they are the party in power now.
So it's hard to find a Democrat to step forward in an atmosphere where the people want something different from what they've been getting.
John Bacino with the State Democrats does not describe the party as having problems. He points out the seat held by Max Baucus now has been in Democratic control for 100 years.
That's no anomaly. That truly this party has spoken for Montanans for generations, and I think that nothing has changed in the last few years.
Democrats say they will make sure their base is mobilized no matter who their candidate for U.S. Senate ends up being in 2014. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, Glacier Park's historic hotels may be owned by the National Park Service and sit within the park's borders, but the lederhosen-clad staff of the many Glacier Hotel and the cooks, waiters, and bartenders at Lake McDonald Lodge don't work for the park, but for the company running these businesses. That company has been the same for more than three decades. Glacier Park recently announced the Colorado-based Zantara Parks and Resorts Incorporated will replace Glacier Park Incorporated as the concessioner operating these businesses. Catherine Fry reports the change will come with the new year.
In 1981, Glacier Park Incorporated bought out the concessioner who was running the lodges and restaurants inside the park. GPI has been running the Lake McDonald Lodge, Many Glacier Hotel, Swift Current Motor Inn, Rising Sun Motor Inn, the Village Inn at Apgar, the Red Buses, the Two Medicine Camp Store, and the park restaurants. That contract ended in 2006, and GPI has been working on one-year extension contracts since then as the Park Service organized the process to put the contract out to bid. Acting Superintendent of Glacier Park, Kim Hall, says federal legislation in 1998 put the National Park in charge of the buildings.
And then when the legislation went into place where we took over ownership, then they became the proprietor of that contract. So this is actually the first time that this contract has been bid in this way under the current legislation. So it's a little bit of a new process for us, but we're just catching up with what's been going on around the country.
The Colorado-based Zanterra that's taking over operations at Glacier Park operates visitor services in national and state parks, including Crater Lake, Death Valley, Grand Canyon, Petrified Forest, Rocky Mountain, Yellowstone, and Zion National Parks, and Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Hall says the park owns the hotels and the red buses, and the bid went out to see who would operate the businesses in these spaces.
And so then they have a contract for the right to operate those and to turn a profit, to make a profit from those businesses. And then they hire the appropriate staff with the appropriate skills. They also have a requirement to put some of their revenue back into maintenance of those buildings. So where they need new carpeting, where they need paint, where they need a new roof.
The contract with Glacier Park requires the company to reserve a little more than 2% of its annual gross revenue for repair and maintenance of the buildings, and 2.5% aside for a red bus rehabilitation reserve. The annual gross receipts are expected to be about $18.5 million. That projected revenue number boils down to about $430,000 each year reserved for maintenance and repairs, and $460,000 each year reserved for red bus rehabilitation. The Zanterra contract lasts for the next 16 years. President of Glacier Park Incorporated, Cindy Agyanov, says they're disappointed to have lost the contract, but wish Zanterra well and will be working with them during transition as well as being neighbors. GPI still owns the Prince of Wales Hotel and Glacier's Canadian counterpart, Waterton Park, as well as the St. Mary Lodge, the Glacier Park Lodge in East Glacier, and the Grouse Mountain Lodge in Whitefish. Agyanov says their contract differed from the current one, but the percentages that go back to repair and maintenance are similar. Hall says the contract gives very specific parameters in some cases on how the business is supposed to be run.
And some of that is what are the services to be provided, what are some of the dates that things have to be done by.
The contract also gives approved rates for hotel rooms, other price guidelines, and minimum maximum dates of operation, as well as specific and more general maintenance requirements on the buses and buildings.
But they are expected, and that would have been part of their offer, to have a team of people who help them make those types of judgment calls within their operation. Oh, we're having some plumbing issues over here. We need to rehab this line, and this water line or wastewater line, and we've got to factor that into our operations.
Hall says the park has a staff that works with the concessioner overseeing what's being done, and part of the contract involves a minimum franchise fee of 1% of gross receipts going back to the Park Service each year.
Really, we're talking with them pretty much daily, if not more frequently, to make sure that the work is getting done, to make sure that expectations are being met, that the quality of the experience they're providing, the quality of the services are as top-notch as we would expect and that they're capable of doing.
Reservations will continue being made through the GPI reservation system and will get transferred over to Zanterra when the time comes. This concessions contract does not affect campgrounds, backcountry chalets or outfitting, or the bulk of the businesses in Apgar, which are mostly privately owned. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Missoula voters this fall will be asked to consider a $1.7 million mill levy request for Mountain Line, the local public bus service. Advocates of the proposal touted Mountain Line's contributions to the community during a mill levy campaign kickoff event held today at Mountain Line's downtown transfer center. Now, in its 35th year, Mountain Line provides over 900,000 rides annually. And in 1976, Missoula voters created the Missoula Urban Transportation District to operate Mountain Line, which opened its doors a year later. The district hasn't placed a mill levy increase on the ballot since its formation more than 35 years ago. If approved, Mountain Lion says the funds would be used to add van services for seniors and people with disabilities, extended bus service until 9:50 p.m. on four popular bus routes, and increased bus frequency on two high routes to reduce wait times. Missoula Mayor John Engen is treasurer of Friends of Mountain Lion, a committee created to support the mill levy request. Engen noted the service continues to see increased ridership.
But ultimately what Mountain Lion is for the mayor of the city of Missoula is a guarantee that folks in our community who might not otherwise have any form of transportation to manage their lives have a form of transportation. They have a reliable way to get around, and that is critical to any community that can call itself a community.
Engen added that quality local development goes hand in hand with an effective public transit system.
And whenever I talk about development today, high quality development in Missoula, Montana, I can't do it without talking about the Mountain Lion bus system, because they go hand in hand. They are so integral. We have a fantastic system, and it's only going to get better. It should go without saying that a bus system probably shouldn't stop at 5 or 6 o'clock. With this mill levy, it won't, right? We'll have evening service, so a whole bunch of folks whose lives stop in some ways in the early evening can go on later into the evening, and that's a wonderful thing for our community.
Other speakers pointed out how critical Missoula bus service is to the elderly, those who need access to medical care, and offers opportunities for daily exercise by walking or cycling to the bus stop. University of Montana senior Topher Williams says Mountain Lion service is critical for the UM community.
For starters, it's essential that students have good access to campus for classes, for work, for things like that. Think about it. We have upwards of 15,000 people congregating in 1 square mile of the city on every single day. It's essential that we have the opportunity for students to have transportation options and to take the bus. We also have students who work at places like the mall, oftentimes until late hours of the evening. Allowing them to have a connection between the mall and campus and their homes is absolutely critical. It's become so expensive to drive in the last few years that oftentimes owning a car can compete with tuition.
If approved in November, the annual cost of Missoula's Mountain Lion mill levy request in property taxes would be approximately $19 on a home valued at $100,000 or $38 on a $200,000 home.
The American Cancer Society's nonprofit advocacy affiliate released a report today outlining how Montana legislative activity affects cancer prevention outcomes. The Cancer Action Network's state-by-state reports finds that Montana's falling short on its cancer-fighting policies. The Cancer Society estimates over 1.6 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer, and more than 500,000 will die of the disease this year. In Montana, it's estimated over 5,000 people will get a cancer diagnosis in 2013, and 2,000 will succumb to the disease. In this evening's feature interview, the Cancer Action Network's Montana Government Relations Director, Kristen Page Nye, explains what's working well in Montana and what needs improvement. The report provides a color-coded chart of 11 specific policies. A green means the state's adopted evidence-based policies and best practices. Yellow means moderate movement toward the benchmark, and red means the state's policies are falling short. The first policy centers around smoke-free laws, for which Montana received a green color.
Yes, back in, I believe it was 2005, we were able to work with the state legislature and the governor to pass a statewide clean indoor air law, which went into full effect for all public and workplaces in 2009. At that time, it included bars and restaurants. And since that has been in place, we've had great success with businesses complying. I believe the last time I checked, businesses were over 95% in compliance with that law. And so that means more people at their workplaces are protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke.
And yet there are dust-ups every now and then, as we just read about in Great Falls, yeah?
Yeah, we're actively working at that local level in Great Falls with community members and the medical community to educate those handful of business owners that are basically not complying with the law, and trying to educate them on how they're truly putting their employees at risk.
And moving on, tobacco tax and price increase over time, where Montana earns a red. Why?
We have had success in the past increasing the tax on tobacco products. Right now, Montana's tax on cigarettes is $1.70. The reason why the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network supports increasing the tax on tobacco products is because it is a highly effective way to prevent kids from becoming long-term smokers. They're the most price sensitive. So for every 10% that you raise the price of a pack of cigarettes, you're going to see up to a 6 to 7% reduction in youth prevalence. This is huge. Whenever you see a state increase that tax, you see a significant drop in youth prevalence and also in adult prevalence as well, just not as significant. It has been, I believe, since 2005 since we have last increased that tax here. And that policy strategy is only effective if you're doing it over a period of time. You can't just do it one time. You have to do it fairly frequently.
And yet the next category, the tobacco tax rate, we get a green.
We do have a fairly high tax on cigarette products, but we have not in recent years increased the tax. The other thing that I should mention is that there's a disparity in Montana in how other tobacco products are taxed. Right now, there is not parity between how cigarettes are taxed and, say, snus. And as we work with lawmakers, work to improve the definitions and how those products will be taxed.
Okay, and the last of our tobacco categories here is tobacco prevention funding. I was always under the impression we did rather well on that topic here, but it gets a yellow grade.
Yeah, and good observation, Edward. Really, we have done fabulous in this category as a state in investing in funding for an evidence-based statewide tobacco prevention and cessation program up until two legislative sessions ago. And at that time, the legislature zeroed out the program during the session, and by the end of the session, they added back partial funding. The problem with that is the decision by the legislature wasn't based on the hard science or the evidence. They just picked a number out of the air that felt good to them. It takes more money and more resources to really make sure kids don't start that habit.
Okay, the next three categories all get a red grade here. Indoor tanning bed restrictions, physical education time requirements, and breast and cervical cancer early detection. Briefly, let's go through those three.
Sure. Indoor tanning beds, we do not have a state law that prevents youth from tanning in Montana. And in recent years, the national experts have identified tanning booths as type 1 carcinogen, basically highly dangerous, especially for youth to use tanning beds. People who use indoor tanning booths in their teens and their 20s have a 75% increase in melanoma risk. And so we will be looking at that this next legislative session and look forward to working with legislative champions to pass that legislation.
And as far as PE goes, there's no time requirement in our schools for that?
If you look at state statute, there is no time requirement. If you look at the quasi-government that oversees our schools, there is a requirement for physical activity and health, but it really doesn't clearly define how much of that should be minutes with physical activity and how much should be in health. The evidence shows that if there are X number of minutes in a day that a child is required to have physical activity, that far improves their outcomes for preventing obesity and chronic diseases such as cancer that can come about in the long run.
And then another red grade, breast and cervical cancer early detection. And I seem to remember this was an issue early on in the U.S. Senate race last year.
Yeah. The state of Montana and the local health departments do a fabulous job with the resources they have to reach out and inform women who are basically the working poor, those women who don't make enough to be on public assistance, but they make too much to afford private insurance. to provide screening, and then if they do identify a precancer or cancer of the breast or cervix, then they do qualify for the duration of their treatment for Medicaid. The problem is there's way more women in that category that qualify than we have resources at this time. So one approach that our organization has had with our partners is to encourage the states to match those funds.
And the next two issues, pain policy and access to palliative care. We get a green where Montana is adopting evidence-based policies and best practices when it comes to our pain policy, but it seems a little more guarded response to the access to palliative care, yeah?
Yes, we have been a part of a very successful pain initiative over the last, I'd say, 7 or 8 years. Was actually housed in the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And through the work of that coalition, we were able to do some amazing work to not only improve guidelines for doctors and for physical therapists and providers in general, but we were also able to work on provider practice improvement. So you have a policy, but it's only as good as the provider puts it into practice. And we've had great success in that area here in Montana. Palliative care, a lot of people associate that with end of life, but that's really, really far from what palliative care is. It's basically the continuum of care from the moment someone is diagnosed with a chronic disease such as cancer and through the duration of their life. So the key is to both look at policies that can help with extending life for somebody with chronic disease and then also enhancing the quality of life gained. This is fairly new, not just to Montana, but also to the nation. So this is, I would say, one of the emerging policies that we're really working hard on.
And the very last issue, another red grade, red flag, the Medicaid expansion, which we heard a great deal about this last legislative session, and much to the governor's chagrin, Medicaid expansion was not approved.
Right, and much to the chagrin of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, too. We know we could prevent nearly half of cancer deaths if people had access to and were physically active, were eating right, and just said no to tobacco products and were not exposed to secondhand smoke. But the final leg of that stool is having access to care. For cancer patients, it's access to early detection. We know that people have better outcomes, live longer, better quality of life when they get those screenings on a regular basis based on the best practices, you know, whether it be colon cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer. We also know that people get better treatment when they have access to care. They're more likely to keep their appointments, to not skip treatment, or choose not to undergo treatments because they don't want to put that financial burden on their families.
Lawmakers who voted against it, well, the essential argument was, look, the federal dollars aren't going to be there always, and then eventually the state will get stuck with that enormous tab. Did they have a valid point?
I really do not think that is a valid point. I think that they're going to have a much bigger tab if they don't address this, because these hardworking, low-income folks tend to have worse outcomes on their health. And that is going to cost us much more in the long run. And I think there was an assumption made that those folks that would be on Medicaid expansion would be the sickest folks, and that's simply not the case. This added population would not just be those who cost the most to the system.
What now? What does the Cancer Action Network recommend?
Well, we know the formula now. We know the priority policies that will help us reduce cancer incidence and reduce the deaths from cancer. Now we really have a lot of work to do, especially here in Montana, to further those policies so that we have more success and better quality of life for cancer patients.
Kristen Page Nye, Montana Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 80s to mid-90s. For central Montana, tonight will be mostly clear with lows around 55 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow expect sunny skies with highs around 85 to 95 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for mostly clear skies with lows in the lower 50s. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs around 85 to 95 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Terry Roberts.
The buzz around buying local is fairly widespread, and luckily, our community has many options for access to locally grown and produced food. Local food can be purchased in many retail grocery stores, and from May to October, there are a number of farmers markets available. How can we take the idea of supporting our local food system one step farther? The answer is community-supported agriculture. You may have heard of community-supported agriculture, also known as CSAs, or CSA shares, or a CSA box, or maybe even food shares. But really, what is it? A CSA is a direct agreement between a grower or a group of growers and someone who enjoys eating and therefore purchasing local food, like you and me. It works like this. Ted is a local grower of a variety of produce. Karen wants to purchase local produce. Prior to harvest season, Ted offers to sell his produce via a CSA share in the amount of $350, delivered over the course of 20 weeks. Ted's produce will be picked a day or two prior to delivery. Karen pays Ted the share price of $350 before Ted begins harvesting his earliest crops. When June finally rolls around and Ted has harvested spinach, green garlic, kale, bok choy, radishes, and lettuce, he delivers to a predetermined location where Karen meets up with Ted and receives her fresh produce. This repeats throughout the growing season. So why are CSA programs so effective in supporting local agriculture? The answer is shared risk. When Karen purchased Ted's CSA share before he started harvesting, she agreed to share the risk of crop failure along with the benefits of a strong local food system. In conventional farming, all risks are on the grower. When we talk about a strong local food system as a beneficial food system, what do we mean? Economically, the direct link from grower to consumer allows our grocery dollars to remain local. Considering the high percentage of our incomes used for the purchase of food, this is significant. Many of our local CSA programs are able to accept SNAP benefits, creating access to members of our community with lower incomes. A strong local food system also is good for the environment. Area growers involved with CSA programs are typically certified organic or are involved with the Montana Sustainable Growers Union, which means there is emphasis on soil quality, conservation of water, and the enrichment of habitat without use of chemicals. Let's use Ted as an example again. Instead of chemical fertilizers, Ted builds his soil by composting, using cover crops, and crop rotation. There is also a food safety issue that isn't always talked about as a benefit of a strong local food system. E. coli-laced spinach has turned up again recently, and the source is a large corporate organic farm. Montana was on the list of states where the deadly spinach was shipped. Knowing your farmer by purchasing directly via a CSA allows for transparency of practices that is a difficult relationship to have with a corporate farm. Often, our local growers share their farming practices via a website or Facebook page and are accessible via email or phone. Karen could call up Ted to ask him about his practices with soil amendments and share her concerns over the use of a manure as fertilizer for a spinach crop. Ted can put Karen's mind at ease by explaining to her that he does not use raw manure for fertilizing his spinach crop and has found a very effective means of building soil safely, as described earlier, creating the wholesome Bloomsdale spinach included with her CSA. Community building is another benefit of a strong local food system. It is common for growers to communicate directly with CSA members via email updates, newsletters, and social networking, where members can comment and share recipes. What's next for CSA programs to further strengthen the local food system? The next steps are twofold. The expansion of warehousing is needed to accommodate storage vegetable crops for winter distribution. Also important is coalition building with community organizations to identify areas where access to local food is challenging for reasons related to income and location. Collaboratively, we can strive to make CSA shares more economically and physically available so that everyone living in our Western Montana communities can enjoy the benefits of a strong local food system. In Missoula, Montana, I'm Terry Roberts for the Western Montana Growers Co-op and the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. Arrow has been linking people with sustainable agriculture and energy solutions since 1974. Visit us online at arrowmt.org.
Terry Roberts is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.